From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Now back to the FBI raids on that Michigan-based militia group, which is now accused of hatching plans to kill police officers, as the group members said they were waiting for the coming of the Antichrist.
The news that a militia group called Hutari had been foiled in its plot to foment a violent uprising capped a week of verbal and physical rage that ricocheted around U.S. politics. The intensity of the Hutari's anger and the looniness of their plot seemed to have taken the media by surprise, but it didn't particularly shock Mark Potok. The information director for the Southern Poverty Law Center and former journalist who covered the rise of the militia movement in the 1990s, Potok leads the center's annual census of hate groups and extremism. The most recent study, just published, found that in the last 18 months, since shortly before President Obama's election, the number of right-wing hate groups had grown to 512, an increase of 244%, and anti-immigrant vigilante groups soared by nearly 80%. Potok's job is to ferret out these groups and their plans. But he says that much of their anger and alienation is hiding in plain sight, as the Hutari's website, complete with paramilitary videos, showed all too well.
A great many of them are quite easy to find. I mean, we had found the Hutari militia long before these indictments, about a year earlier. They had a whole MySpace section, and then, of course, we found their website and so on. The way we collect our information ranges from the very simple, collecting media accounts, broadcast news accounts, and so on, to getting into sometimes secret email groups. We have a lot of interaction with law enforcement. Someone comes out of a group, they've broken up with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, and they're ready to talk. So, of course, you snatch up those people and talk to them. And in addition, I have a staff of investigative reporters who do on-the-ground investigative work. So it's certainly not merely a desk job.
How do you make sure your research has the maximum impact?
It has been a very good thing for us in terms of communicating with the public to count, to actually show what these groups are, what their names are, where they are located, what type of group they are. I think probably the most important single educational tool we've ever devised is the hate group map that we have on our website. And I think huge numbers of people are absolutely shocked. In fact, the Ku Klux Klan still exists. In fact, there really are uniform neo-Nazi groups, and sometimes right there in the town next door that they had no idea about.
How significant a factor do you think the internet plays in fostering the anti-government movements that you've been looking at? You've talked about social media like MySpace. Are there other mechanisms that are providing fuel for this fire?
Well, let me answer in this way. In the mid-90s, when the internet came into existence, at least on a broad basis, most of these groups felt that this was the answer to their dreams, because once they were able to get their message to the people without the sort of mediation of the elites, that, of course, the people would rise up and join them and all would be well, ultimately. That naturally hasn't happened. The websites of these groups have been much less effective at recruiting people than the groups had hoped. That said, if you think about, say, a white supremacist 30 years ago, that individual tended to be a very isolated person. They couldn't really go down to the corner bar and start confiding their ideology to the person on the next bar stool because they might get their nose broken. That same person today gets up in the morning, turns on the computer. There are all kinds of discussions going on in the various forums about strategy and ideology. People are announcing or organizing events. So that person now feels like he is part of a movement.
Now, we've heard a lot of hot rhetoric since the campaign and an increasingly paranoid and confrontational political landscape since Obama's election. How do you separate the overheated speech of pundits and politicians from the hate speech of groups that pose a viable threat?
Really, I would say that the problem is that much of the hate speech and especially the kind of defamatory propaganda and conspiracy theories that come out of these radical right-wing groups, hate groups and patriot groups, so-called, is making its way into the mainstream. And that kind of conveyor belt movement from the margins to the mainstream is being very much aided, at least in the last year or two, by a number of mainstream politicians or ostensibly mainstream politicians and media commentators.
I assume you're talking about politicians like Michelle Bachmann and cable TV and talk radio pundits like Glenn Beck. Am I correct?
Yes, I'm talking about when Michelle Bachmann says President Obama is setting up political re-education camps all around the country, presumably to turn our children into Marxist robots. I'm talking about when Steve King, a congressman out of Iowa, says that 25 Americans every single day are either murdered or run over and killed by drunken, as he would say, criminally illegal aliens. Or when Glenn Beck on Fox News talks about the possibility that the Federal Emergency Management Agency is running a set of secret concentration camps to intern good of patriotic Americans. All of that and much more. That is becoming quite common today.
And do you see a direct connection or merely a circumstantial one between those big mouths and the violence from these groups, not just threats, but actual attempts?
Well, it's very difficult to say, Glenn Beck is responsible for this or that killing. On the other hand, perhaps there is some fairly direct association, for instance, between the many years of defamatory talk about Latino immigrants from Lou Dobbs and certain others, and the fact that anti-Latino hate crimes went up by 40% between 2003 and 2007. There's no way to draw a direct link. It's certainly not legal responsibility, but moral responsibility, I think there probably is quite a bit.
How about civilians, non-journalists? How can they use the media to battle this?
I do think that a very important role of normal, everyday Americans with regard to the media is to call the media to account when that is required. Last year, there was a real campaign against Lou Dobbs. It more or less began after Dobbs seemed to cross the line into birther territory to suggest that Obama should show his birth certificate and so on. We had never called for Dobbs' firing up to that moment, but that seemed to us to really cross the Rubicon, and we did call. And a large number of other civil rights and immigrant rights organizations repeated the call. But that was joined by thousands and thousands and thousands of everyday Americans, some of whom even did things like demonstrate in front of CNN headquarters in Atlanta. And Dobbs left, apparently at a cost of $8 million to CNN. So I don't think that that is something that could have been accomplished only by civil rights groups or immigrant rights groups. I do think the public played a really important role.
Mark, thank you very much.
And thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Mark Potok is the Director of Publications and Information for the Southern Poverty Law Center. The media invariably refer to groups like the Hutari as militias, which they are. But you could argue that the word terrorists would also apply. Daniel Levitas, author of The Terrorists Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right, says he's fine with using the term militia. It's more specific, as long as we keep the nature of these groups' terrorist activities in the backs of our minds. That's important because law enforcement agencies frequently employ a double standard when labeling some offenders terrorists and others as just plain criminals. Take William Krar. In 2003, the 63-year-old Texan was caught with a sodium cyanide bomb, along with 60 pipe bombs and 500,000 rounds of ammunition. The Justice Department didn't make a big deal out of Krar. It just sent out a few low-level press releases. And it didn't call him a terrorist, a decision reflected in how it chose to prosecute him.
They gave William Krar his full constitutional rights. He ended up pleading guilty. He had access to a lawyer, all the rest. You compare that with how the Justice Department treated Jose Padilla, who was arrested in Chicago O'Hare. He was a former gang member who had then affiliated with Al-Qaeda. None other than John Ashcroft, the former attorney general, interrupted a trip in Moscow, of all places, to announce in an international press conference the arrest of Padilla. Here you have Jose Padilla, an American citizen, William Krar, also an American citizen. Padilla is shipped off to a military brig in South Carolina, where he essentially rotted in a cell for more than 3 years, denied access to counsel. The Justice Department, of course, shouted from the rooftops he was a terrorist. And then later basically recanted most of their allegations against him. He never had a bomb or any weapon in his possession. Compare that to William Krar, who actually did have a fully functional chemical weapon. Krar was never labeled a terrorist. He was given access to a lawyer, as he should have been and as Padilla should have been.
Is this story exceptional?
There are many other examples of Americans that have engaged in acts of political violence. For example, the long-running conspiracy in the United States to murder abortion clinic providers. This is clearly a network of domestic terrorists. They have underground networks of safe houses and communication and so on. The FBI has never labeled those organizations domestic terrorists of any kind.
To what do you attribute the double standard?
The desire on the part of the federal government is to keep the focus and the attention of the American public on an enemy from abroad.
Why?
Well, because I think it undermines the moral authority of our fight against that kind of terrorism when we say that there are people in this country who wrap themselves in the flag and espouse a mantra of patriotism and yet are still as vicious as Al-Qaeda.
As you watch the reporting, what sort of ideas would you recommend news consumers bring to the reading of these stories?
Don't just look at how the press is characterizing what the organizations have done. You know, with the internet these days, you can look at the indictment itself and directly at what these groups espouse. These guys had a YouTube video. They had their own political paraphernalia all over the internet. People should investigate what the ideology and message of these organizations are to kind of assess whether they think, as media consumers, the organization is being fairly characterized.
Get to know these guys in their own words. The information's out there.
Absolutely. And take them seriously. I mean, too often, these organizations are just caricatured, sometimes deservedly so, but they do have ideas, racist beliefs about the future of America, anti-Semitic ideas about Jews running the government. These are not ideas that are confined to a fringe single-digit percentage of the population. But when people see headlines about these groups and say, oh, only a handful of nuts would believe that living out on some farm in Michigan, that's disturbingly not necessarily the case.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Daniel Levitas is the author of The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement, and The Radical Right.
Coming up, explanatory journalists meet their Waterloo on the banking regulation beat.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After squeezing healthcare reform through Congress in recent weeks, the Obama administration is moving on.
Healthcare is done, so what's next?
I think it seems clear financial regulatory reform cracking down on
financial regulation, which I think is going to be the next big issue on the president's agenda.
Next up, retooling government regulation of the financial system in an effort to head off future meltdowns. But if, as we reported last week, most Americans have a hard time understanding healthcare, what are our chances of cutting through the emotions and preconceptions that fog the debate over financial reform? National Public Radio's Adam Davidson has spent the last 2 years breaking down the economic crisis on, for example, the Giant Pool of Money episode of This American Life and on NPR's podcast Planet Money. And he uses clear, simple language to explain the complicated. But he says financial regulation has proven resistant to even his brand of explanatory journalism.
Most topics I've covered, there's a Cliff Notes version that at least helps you understand the bigger stuff you don't understand. I find that when you simplify regulatory reform, you distort it so much that you don't understand it at all. I have not found a way to tell the story narratively where you're simplifying it but retaining the essence of it.
Is it about the conventions of journalism that make this subject so hard to tackle?
I think that there are many things in the conventions of journalism that make it hard to tackle, but I also think it is the subject itself. One of the formative journalistic experiences in my life was covering the war in Iraq, and you had all these ethnic and religious groups that most people hadn't heard of, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, and they're fighting for things most people didn't know about. Turned out that was actually not that hard to get across, I found. Then the financial crisis became the main focus of my work, and I thought, oh boy, this is totally different because at least in Iraq, you had things like guns, bombs, political parties. You had words that we know. Here's a financial crisis about subprime mortgages and collateralized debt obligations and interest rate variability. variations due to risk spreads. I mean, the language is totally opaque. Well, with a lot of hard work, we were able to translate the words and help the average person at least get a good, solid understanding of what was at stake for the various players in the crisis, why the crisis might have happened, who made mistakes. But regulatory reform is just another level of impenetrability. We just have not been able to, in a four-minute radio story, in an hour on the radio, in writing long explanations on the blog, we have not found a way to convey it in anything like a piece of journalism that a non-expert consumer can pick up and get value out of.
I used to have a linguistics teacher who said to me that if you can't put something into words, then you really don't understand it.
I might really not understand it. I mean, it's very, very complicated. And the more I delve into it, the more I realize nobody fully understands it. Also, it's not just that it's too complicated. It's counterintuitive. The more someone tells you this is a morality play, this is about bad bankers and good ordinary citizens, the more they're lying to you.
We see a lot of people getting ripped off. We see the banks suffering very little as a result of mistakes that they made. Why isn't it a morality play?
I guess the way to put it is not that it's not a morality play, but it is thousands of morality plays. You cannot say that bankers are one group and citizens are one group. That's nuts. We know on the citizen side, just probably from any family picnic, that citizens are responsible, citizens are irresponsible. Well, banks are too. You have investment banks, you have commercial banks, you have small banks, you have large banks, you have hedge funds, you have all sorts of people doing all sorts of different things on Wall Street. And there is no one agenda. There certainly is a morality play to be told. There are certainly names of people who clearly did things that are probably immoral and probably should be punished. I'm just saying it's not a simple morality play. And there is no piece of regulation that is good for banking. It's good for one part of banking.
In the case of regulation, this is a binary argument. Generally, you have the Democrats or the public advocates on one side portrayed as wanting more regulation. And then on the other side, you have the Republicans who feel that the market works better the less the heavy hand of government is intruding into it. Right?
I think that is the frame. Yeah, I think you're right that that is a core frame that lots of people have. But that's exactly wrong. For example, Democrats, yes, they generally pay lip service to being against the banks. But where is the center of power of banking in America? New York, Connecticut, Boston, Democratic strongholds. And you have many, many big city Democrats who are extremely close to Wall Street, to the banking system, to the insurance system. And who are some people who are extremely skeptical and always have been for hundreds of years of these big city Northeast bankers, rural areas, especially in the South. That's a very longstanding trope in American politics. And you have lots of Republicans from those districts. So you actually look at how they vote, the legislation they craft, where they get their money, how they exercise their power in the financial system. It's quite clear that it does not break down in that way.
Another sort of simple frame we hear a lot is whether or not this is an overhaul.
Well, a massive, massive financial overhaul is now on its way to the full U.S. Senate.
The Obama administration and Democrats in Congress said Wednesday that an overhaul of financial regulation was the next legislative priority.
Senator Christopher Dodd, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, will unveil legislation today to overhaul the nation's financial regulation system.
There were an awful lot of people who are experts on banking regulation who had hoped that this would be an opportunity to look over our system and overhaul it. Nobody ever designed the U.S. financial system. There was a crisis in 1907. Congress responded with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Then there was a crisis in the 30s. Congress responded with a whole host of reforms. Basically, they respond to the last crisis. They do so in a way that's extremely political. So I think there was some hope that we would do something like what the British did in the 80s, which is say, forget it. We're getting rid of all the history and we're starting from scratch. We're not doing anything like that. The basic structure of our financial system will be close to identical. There will be some tweaks. But it's just not fair to call it an overhaul.
There's another problem with reporting this story. You spoke with former Senator Ben Campbell of Colorado, who was on the banking committee, and he said this about regulation.
Oh, God, it's boring. Yeah, that's right. I was on banking four years in the state legislature and on banking a short period of time in the Senate. I think it was the most boring thing I ever did. That's to say nothing, I didn't understand some of that stuff.
Do you think the sheer soul-sucking tedium of it is part of the problem?
It's all about slight adjustments in interest rates and various legal schemes. Yes, it results in massive, huge impacts on all of our lives. It means our financial system is more or less fragile. It means our economy grows or doesn't grow. But it is so, so, so boring. And we have tried. We've used songs. We've used theater sketches. We've interviewed over 100 economists trying to find the ones who can just really nail an explanation in a clear, concise way. And honestly, like, we've picked off pieces. We've told little elements of it. But the big, here is what regulation is all about, and we're going to tell you how it works, we have not been able to crack. I feel like I have seen the edge of what journalism can accomplish, of what journalism is capable of, and the bulk of financial regulatory reform is on the other side of that edge.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Adam Davidson reports for Planet Money, a co-production of NPR and This American Life.
Remember back in the old days when Americans hated banks and Wall Street and wanted financial executives stripped of their salaries and gold bathroom faucets? That was before CFPA, which, according to the Chamber of Commerce, is much, much worse.
Americans are losing sleep over this economy, especially small business owners worrying about payroll and mounting bills. Now Washington wants to make it worse with the CFPA, a massive new federal agency that will create more layers of regulation and bureaucracy.
The CFPA is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which the Obama administration wants as part of financial reform legislation, but which business groups and congressional Republicans are portraying as yet another intrusion by big government into our lives. Want to learn more? Visit StopTheCFPA.com.
This is kind of an echo that we've heard of in the healthcare debate, you know, how bad government is.
Bill Buesenberg is executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit that investigates the impact of lobbying money on official Washington. He says that the financial sector has poured more cash into congressional campaign coffers than pharma, telecom, or even energy.
Since 89, $2.3 billion. Almost 20% of all contributions to candidates and PACs and committees have come from the financial industry.
Which means, he says, that lobbyists have already purchased the attention of the senators who may this summer be voting on reform and surely will be financing more advertising designed to deflect attention from greedy and ruinous speculation to a non-existent bailout. This from a GOP group calling itself the Committee for Truth in Politics. Amid ominous music, the text warns about the $4 trillion big bank bailout. Somehow, it neglects to mention that the fund would be paid for not by Joe taxpayer, but by the financial industry itself.
Is it, you know, 100% accurate? No political advertising is ever 100% accurate.
Evan Tracy is president of the Campaign Media Analysis Group.
What it is in all forms of advertising, but especially in political, it's really about your version of the truth. You're going to try and couch this legislation in the way that it's going to help you the most politically.
Big finance's determination to shift perceptions, he says, is not limited to policy ads. Tracy points to ads by large banks, which have increasingly stopped talking about free checking and begun emphasizing, perhaps more nostalgically than accurately at the current moment, how they make the loans that keep our economy running.
It's very much like the energy debate, where all of a sudden you don't hear Exxon talking about putting a tiger in your tank anymore as much as you talk about them being the different kind of energy company.
British Petroleum turns its logo into a green leaf, and GMAC, the finance arm of General Motors that was beneficiary of billions in TARP money, rechristens itself as Ally Bank. It is difficult, after all, to explain what's not so bad about the status quo, but it's really easy to change the subject. Political protest in the Arab world can be risky, especially for a woman. But a Saudi Arabian housewife named Hissa Halal has found an unlikely avenue for protest that might just make her rich. Hilal is one of five finalists on the Arabic poetry competition called The Millions Poet. It's kind of like American Idol, except for the poetry, and it's the most popular reality show in the Persian Gulf. Hilal's poetry, which she recites covered head to toe but for a slit revealing her eyes, condemns Islamic extremism and has earned her both death threats and the solid support of the show's judges and of millions of text messaging viewers. Hassan Hassan writes for the Abu Dhabi-based newspaper The National, and he's here to tell us what Hilal's success represents. Hassan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I think it would be very difficult for American listeners to get their heads around the idea of a television show devoted to the recitation of poetry. Tell me where Bedouin poetry fits into the pop culture in the Gulf states.
Everyone in the street would tell you their favorite lines of poetry. In Arabic, we say poetry is the oral history of Arabs, a means to tell stories, to talk about social, political, and religious issues. It's for everyone.
Now, tell me about Hissa Halal. Her poetry, from what I've read, criticizes various clerics who have issued what she regards as dangerous, unnecessary, and extreme fatwas, especially those calling for the death of people who would put women and men in the same workplace and in the same educational institution. What has been the reaction to that kind of sentiment expressed on Pan-Gulf TV?
The poem has been very well received. If you talk about the people in the street, the jury panel, everyone I've spoken with, they were really impressed with the poem. She comes across as very passionate about what she says. She considered the fatwas personal.
Now, you mentioned that she's a Saudi. This is maybe the most conservative of the Gulf states, and women are covered pretty much head to toe. They can't drive. They are seldom in the workplace and are not necessarily welcomed as voices of political commentary, correct?
Basically, there is an extremist view among Islamists which says the voice of the woman is an awra. Awra is an Arabic word for the part of the body that should be covered by clothing. It should not be exposed to other people.
And there have been death threats to her and to her family. Tell me about the most extreme reactions to this episode.
The death threats were issued in an online forum. Some member in that forum said, anyone has her address so I can kill her. Another one was discussing what kind of death she deserves. She said she's mostly concerned about her family. She has four children. But she said, I'm not concerned about myself. She said, I got scared at the beginning, but I'm fine now.
Do you think that the support for Hilal is representative of public opinion in the Arab world in general?
Absolutely. I think most people agree with her. She is part of a movement, especially young people, who refuse to listen to extremists. They believe they are detrimental to society. But the thing is, in her poem, she criticized not only the people who issue these fatwas, but the people who keep quiet when someone calls for violence and promote terrorism. That was a main theme in her poem that many people didn't speak about.
You have just hit on the thought that has been on a lot of Western minds going back about 9 years, and that is, you know, why in 2010 do these sentiments expressed by one Saudi housewife on a reality show suddenly capture the imagination of the TV audience? Where have these expressions of anger been for the last 9 years?
The movement has always been there. It's increasing because extremism is increasing. They have powerful TV channels and they talk all the time. People watch the TV and see these people. So they get angry. They say, these people don't represent me. These people say all these crazy things. Someone has to say, no, this is wrong. So Hissa is one of them. She said, I should stand up because I believe in peace. I think these people are evil and we should stand up against them.
When are the finals?
Next Wednesday.
Since her broadside against the clerics, Hissa Halal has done a few more poems. One of her most recent was on the theme of the media. What was her take?
In the poem she said, "I join the birds of light in a battle of enlightenment. We want to rise with a world that is fighting its ignorance." So she was talking about, I'm part of a movement. I join the birds to defeat censorship because their goal is to cut the tongue of the truth.
To cut the tongue of the truth. Hassan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Hassan Hassan is a journalist with the English language Abu Dhabi Daily, The National.
Coming up, a kind of lawsuit that suppresses free speech, whether or not you win or lose.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Journalists have long protected the identities of anonymous sources, but what about the anonymous online commenter? The Cleveland Plain Dealer faced controversy last month when it ran a front-page story about a frequent commenter who posted under the username Law Miss. The newspaper alleged that Law Miss was none other than Cuyahoga County Judge Shirley Strickland Saffold, and that the judge had posted controversial opinions about cases and lawyers in her own courtroom, including capital murder cases. The judge denied the charges, and the newspaper was criticized for breaching the trust of its anonymous online commenters. According to the editor of The Plain Dealer, Susan Goldberg, Saffold's online identity was discovered only after a particularly offensive and suspiciously knowledgeable comment was made about the relative of a newspaper employee.
Our reporters are criticized on our website all the time. People say all kinds of things. We do try to make sure that they're not about hate speech or personal disparagement, but this one caught our web editor's attention because it talked about the mental state of one of our reporter's relatives. And so it really had a degree of inside knowledge that was a little bit troubling. So he went and decided to figure out who Law Miss was. At this time, we were able to connect people's handles online with their email addresses. So he made the connection and got the real email address.
I find it vexing that the editorial staff of The Plain Dealer had the ability to locate the email address for the person posting these comments.
Well, let me say first that we are no longer able to get that information. After this happened, this was something that was changed by our parent company.
Then what happened?
Then he did two things that anybody can do. One was he ran the email address through a Google search, and it came up to be Judge Saffold's email. Then the other thing he did was he went to see all of the other comments that Law Miss had made on our site. So that's when we discovered that Law Miss had made 80-plus comments.
About ongoing cases presided over by Judge Saffold, correct?
Right, and these were not small cases. Two of the cases that Law Miss commented on are death penalty cases. One was of a firefighter who shot three people to death, and Law Miss was complaining that he didn't get the death penalty because he was white rather than black. And the other capital case is the one before Judge Saffold right now, that of Anthony Sowell, who is accused of the serial murders of 11 women in Cleveland.
Reporters, including The Plain Dealer, will refuse to cooperate with courts and with law enforcement in identifying an anonymous source on the grounds of reporter source privilege. This would, I'm sure, strike some people as hypocritical in the extreme, no?
It does strike some of our readers as hypocritical. I think it's a totally different thing. If you read our privacy policy, it says that we will sell your name. It says that we can use information about you for any legitimate business purpose. And it says that if the police ask us who you are, we're going to turn over that information. Now, what we do give to sources who give us important information in off-the-record agreements is a guarantee of anonymity. I think these are vastly different.
Now, I have to tell you, Susan, that if I were the editor of The Plain Dealer and I had been shown the evidence that this commenter, Law Miss, was a presiding judge over the very cases on which Law Miss was commenting, it would be all over my page one. I have no quibbles there. However, I might also say whoever got this information or their boss should be fired, including possibly me. This is quite a conundrum, but, you know, how do you, the editor who made that easy decision, deal with the editor who permitted her staff to dig into private information about commenters?
I don't think it was a super easy decision. We didn't, in fact, publish the next day. We made sure we got lots of comment, and we made sure the stories were fair. We also did a companion story that also ran on page one about our decision to do it and sort of the ethical firestorm that we knew that this was going to kick up. But as far as the editor who looked at this, we didn't have a discussion ahead of time. It was just something he went ahead and did. Maybe it was a good decision. Maybe it wasn't a good decision. To me, okay, the decision was made. That's over. Now we've got to go forward, and what do we do?
I should mention, though, that the judge's daughter has stepped forward to claim authorship of some of the comments. Is it possible that, in fact, she had used her mom's email handle to comment online there?
I think anything is possible. Judge Saffold's daughter is 23 years old. The daughter does live in Columbus. These comments involve some great detailed knowledge of the court system in Cleveland and politics in Cuyahoga County. I don't know that we will know for sure. We do know, however, because we did a public records request, that Judge Saffold's computer at the courthouse had been used to connect to plaindealer.com when several of the Law Miss comments were made. Now, they dispute that, but that's what our public record request turned up.
There's yet one other complication to that story, and that is that Judge Saffold has had, at least as reported in The Plain Dealer, an erratic history on the bench and frequently has been the subject of stories which portray some of her statements and judicial decisions in not the best light. And, by the way, she has recently hauled one of your reporters into court to demand that he reveal the source of some information that he had in one of these very murder cases that we've been discussing. Have your motives been questioned?
Certainly our motives have been questioned. They've been questioned by Judge Saffold. I think that they're questioned by some people in the community. So I would just say that we're viewing all of these as individual incidents and doing the best journalistic job that we can do. But you know, Bob, what I've got to say here is what keeps getting lost in this debate is the right of this defendant who is on trial for his life to a fair and impartial judge. I would imagine that those cases could be subject of appeal. I would imagine that the Plain Dealer would be just devastated by criticism about sitting on relevant, important information. The lawyer who was criticized by Judge Saffold as being, and forgive my language, but an Amos and Andy buffoon, who is one of the lawyers representing Anthony Soles, the man accused of all the murders, he had initially asked for Judge Saffold to recuse herself. And after they talked about this on Monday, they decided to have sort of a one-week cooling-off period. And so we'll see what happens next. This is certainly not the end of this story.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate being there.
Susan Goldberg is the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
One of the least known and most lethal threats to free speech is a kind of lawsuit known as a SLAP. It's an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, and it's used by free speech advocates to describe meritless lawsuits intended to spend critics into silence. That's why SLAPs target ordinary citizens more than deep-pocketed media outlets, and why Congress is currently considering anti-SLAP legislation. Producer Nazanin Rafsanjani looks into SLAPs.
Penelope Conan and George Pring were professors at the University of Denver in the early 80s when they held a contest to pick the acronym SLAP. Penelope Conan.
Actually, SLAPs was the runner-up. I made up that one, but the bottle of wine went to somebody who suggested First Amendment repression torts, but we didn't like that particular acronym.
First Amendment repression torts. Oh.
Yeah. So we decided not to go with that one.
Canan says a defining characteristic of a slap is the plaintiff, the person filing the meritless suit, usually loses the case. So why are slaps such a big danger to free speech?
We don't think that they are intended to win on their legal merits. And it turns out way more than 95% get thrown out of court eventually. It's just the eventually and the ordeal of the time that essentially is such a chilling effect on citizens.
Like the Rhode Island homeowner, sued for complaining to the government that her drinking water might be contaminated. Or the New Yorkers, sued for testifying against a proposed real estate deal. Or the members of the Beverly Hills League of Women Voters, who campaigned against a high-rise condo building. They were sued for more than $60 million for libel. Canan says most people have no idea that, for example, the owners of a landfill can sue someone who tells the government they fear their water is polluted. And for that reason, she has mixed feelings when slaps get media attention.
Because somebody in the reading or listening audience has never heard about them before. And then they go, oh my gosh, I never knew this. There's a risk to my speaking out. I better not go to the public hearing.
Speaking out was once confined to public hearings or letters to the editor or picket signs. Today, much of it happens online, and that gets people into trouble. Take the case Commons versus Van Voorhees. In 2008, a Florida man named Christopher Commons repeatedly shot two Siberian Husky dogs. The incident, recorded and narrated by Irish tourists, ended up on YouTube. The sound we're about to play might be a bit upsetting.
Are they actual gunshots? Oh my God, Ziggy shot him! Oh my God!
Local TV stations, the Orlando Sentinel, and CNN, among others, picked up the story. So did grad student Matt Van Voorhees, who slammed the shooter in a post on his blog called Christopher Commons, Barbarian Hillbilly Dog Assassin. Commons is suing Van Voorhees for defamation, but Van Voorhees says this is just about shutting him up. He believes he's being slapped.
If you sue a blogger, you not only shut that person up, but you also, other bloggers become intimidated and censor themselves because they see that people are being sued for this and that it's very costly to defend oneself against a lawsuit.
His lawyer, First Amendment attorney Mark Randazza, says Commons singled out his client on the assumption that a blogger would be easy to scare.
If he had gone after the National Enquirer or if he had gone after the Orlando Sentinel, they have more money than him and they could probably bury him in legal fees. But he thought that this guy who's just a graduate student at the University of Florida might not be able to defend himself as well.
In court papers, Commons says he shot the dogs thinking they were wolves and that they were endangering a herd of cattle. Commons' attorneys declined to be interviewed on tape, citing the ongoing nature of the lawsuit. In a statement, they said they believe the suit is a legitimate defamation case, and it was filed because Van Voorhees misstated facts on his blog. When we consider threats to the First Amendment, we usually think about the government infringing on our rights. But a strategic lawsuit gives anyone rich enough to hire a lawyer the potential power to silence someone else. Attorney Mark Randazza.
Every single person who is online at all is a potential slap suit defendant. Maybe the Dalai Lama isn't because he never says anything negative about anybody. But unless your kid is the Dalai Lama, one day you may come home and find that there's a process server at your door suing you because of something that your kid posted. Or if you have any opinions that are in any way negative about anybody, the same thing.
Randazza recently represented a guy who tweeted that a Hyundai dealership was the worst on the planet. And last year, Horizon Group Management sued a woman for tweeting to 20 people, quote, "Who said sleeping in a moldy apartment was bad for you? Horizon Realty thinks it's okay." Randazza says if you must tweet or blog or even update your Facebook status, for God's sake, protect yourself.
If there's one thing that I could get out to the listeners is that if you have renter's insurance or homeowner's insurance, it's usually so cheap to add defamation coverage to your insurance policy. For me, it was, I think, an additional $3 per year. So now I can say bad things about anybody I want.
Of course, you can't just say any bad thing. For a court to determine a lawsuit is a slap, it must be shown to be without merit. That is, not defamation. But I asked Randazza, isn't it possible that one person's slap is another person's legitimate defamation suit? I can imagine this making people nervous where they think, I don't want people to just be able to say whatever they want about me on the internet.
Well, that's the thing. They can't. My position is not that people should be able to say whatever they want. I'm talking about cases when there is no actual defamation, when it's a frivolous lawsuit.
In the nearly three decades since the term slap was coined, 27 states have enacted some form of anti-slap law. But the protections vary wildly from state to state. Usually, a defendant can file an early motion claiming the suit is meritless and intended only to silence them. Then the plaintiff has to show that the suit has merit before it drags on year after expensive year. Recently, the makers of a product called Magic Jack sued the website Boing Boing. Boing Boing's managing editor Rob Biskitza says they were lucky the suit was filed in California, the state with the strongest anti-slap statute.
Of all the places in America they could have formulated a legal attack on us, that's the place where it's least likely to succeed.
Magic Jack, by the way, is a product that enables you to make phone calls using the internet. Biskitza wrote a short post criticizing Magic Jack's terms of service. The routine post drew a surprisingly strong reaction.
Usually, people who you criticize or make fun of on the internet, they will talk to you, they will open communication, and we've always been prepared to add rebuttals to posts or change posts if we become aware of an objection or if we've written something which is inaccurate. But in this case, they just sued right out the blue.
We contacted Magic Jack and its legal team for comment, but didn't hear back. Biskitza says Boing Boing's lawyers determined that Magic Jack was suing not to win a defamation case, but
just to cause trouble for us, just to try to bully us into getting rid of the post right away. It was a perfect example of the Streisand effect, I think.
That's right, the Streisand effect, as in Barbara Streisand. That's the unintended consequence of publicizing some piece of information you were trying to quash. First Amendment attorney Mark Randazza.
Back in the 90s sometime, a guy published an aerial photograph of Barbara Streisand's house on his webpage. His webpage got maybe 400 hits. Then Barbara Streisand sent a nasty demand letter to him that he needed to take it down right away. So he posted the letter. And I think within a month after that, he had somewhere close to 450,000 hits. Now you have people who are interested in freedom of speech on the internet looking at it. You have people who are interested in Barbara Streisand looking at it. And when plaintiffs decide to bring these claims, the one thing you can be certain of is that the number of people who heard the negative opinions will grow exponentially.
In the end, Magic Jack lost the case. Boing Boing invoked the California anti-slap statute and recouped a portion of its legal fees. Boing Boing's managing editor, Biskitza, says he was always confident they'd win, but he worries about the broader impact of slaps.
We have legal insurance. We have insurance to cover the costs of these kind of actions. We have that stuff available to us because we're an established company. We're an established blog. The most frustrating thing for us is to know that most people would have been easily intimidated by Magic Jack into silence. The reason these companies do this is because it works.
Next week, a public briefing is planned on the first federal anti-slap bill, called the Citizen Participation Act. It was introduced by Tennessee Congressman Steve Cohen. A judge once said about slaps, quote, "Short of a gun to the head, a greater threat to First Amendment expression can scarcely be imagined." That was in 1992, before tweets and Facebook and blogs, before there was so much more speech to silence. For On the Media, I'm Nazanin Rafsanjani.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Justin Ewan. And we finally have an official fan page on Facebook, thanks to OTM listener Ben Applebaum. Thank you, Ben. Just log in to Facebook, do a search for On the Media, and start following us. After all, what are friends for?
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Vilcek Foundation, honoring the contributions of immigrants in the arts and sciences. Congratulating the winners of the 2010 Vilcek Foundation Prizes, Dr. Alexander Farshavsky in the field of biomedical science and Chef Jose Andres in the arts and humanities. More info at vilcek.org. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.